Welcome to The Alexander Standard. Today's episode, an interview with Alex Liros.
Welcome to The Alexander Standard, where we rank all the successors of Alexander the Great. From Perdiccas to...
Cleopatra the Seventh.
My name is Dustin.
And I'm Meredith.
And how you doing, Meredith?
I'm pretty good. We've got a wedding to go to tomorrow. Hopefully less eventful than Philip's wedding.
Oh, look at you. Deep cut. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a interesting episode today. Totally not part two of Ptolemy. But we have ascended, Meredith. Yeah, you can shake your head all you want, but we've ascended because we're interviewing somebody who's awesome. And his name is Alex Liros, and he wrote a play called Aristotle Alexander. Really cool guy. We said some things. Lots of words were exchanged. Knowledge. And you're looking at me in that tone of voice. How about we jump over to that interview?
All right.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. All right, listeners. So with me today is Alex Liros. We are excited to have Alex on our humble podcast today. We are talking about his new play that is just dropped and opened yesterday, and it is Aristotle Alexander, which for anyone who might not be aware with the Alexander Standard is something that was definitely up our alley of interest. So first of all, we just want to say thank you for just so making us feel so awesome that you would want to talk to us. It's a really big honor.
I'm a history buff, freak, nerd. And it's nice that we have so many options out there to share our love of this crazy and wonderful time.
It's a great period. And I should go ahead and say, unfortunately, Meredith wasn't able to join today, but she definitely just wanted to say break a leg. And just to give our listeners a brief overview of who we're talking to here, Alex Liros is certainly someone that we would call the Hollywood Aristotle, in the sense of, as Aristotle is definitely a polymath, that Alex Liros is someone that you definitely know of or heard of and have seen because he's been in everything everywhere. I'm talking about multiple acting roles, multiple writing credits, and multiple roles as a producer. You might see him most recently, well, it looks like it may be coming out, Hungry?
Yes, that is coming out soon.
All right. It's like Sorry Not Sorry, The Comedian, Tut.
Tut was fun. We shot that in Morocco and on the same sets where Gladiator was shot.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was really good. Egypt, a really fun. They did a good job. Yeah, really good.
And you played General Yuya?
Yuya.
Wonderful.
Yeah, he was one of Tut's historical people.
Wonderful. I was just talking about King Tut with my students yesterday. As a producer, got a lot of overlap here. Captain Blackout, Elegy, your film Heterosexuals.
Yeah, that was with Natasha Leone, and that was also a really fun cast written and directed by Rob McCaskill.
Wonderful. And I see as also a writer for Captain Blackout, for Elegy, for Daddy Dynamo.
Yeah, those were some shorts over the years, and now new stuff is coming in the pipeline, starting with... Aristotle Alexander.
Now, I'm also looking here on your website, and I'm seeing some of your early performances and credits. So, Desperelix, Unequilibrium, The Common Air. And one thing I can't help but start out by asking there or taking note of. I was really just intrigued and impressed by your characters. Very commonly seem to be brought in from a multitude of background and perspective.
Yes.
So when you're bringing in characters like that, I mean, clearly just to say multiple perspectives would be to be the understatement, but what goes into and when you're creating characters like this?
You know, everyone's got a story. And whether it's a cab driver or a bartender or, I'm an old octogenarian Greek diner owner.
Indeed.
They all have a story. So as a writer, I listen and I kind of cull the best of it. But I don't judge anybody, and I'm most fascinated by people who have some internal conflict and have some, either they've lost perspective. That's one of my big themes. People who have lost perspective and are because they've just gotten so deep into whatever it is they're doing. So that's definitely a big theme. And then also, showing the very simple, painful sides of life that when you get through them, you can celebrate.
Well, I definitely think with the idea of lost perspective played in a lot with Aristotle Alexander, and I can't wait to talk to you about that. Say that last part again, just want to make sure I understand it, about when they're coming out on the other side.
You know, it's the famous Nietzsche quote, which people do not often quote fully. And the quote is, in life's school of war, what does not kill me makes me stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, life is school. And that's actually another theme that's in the play. The Athens is the school of Greece.
Yes,
and
it
everyone
is.
Goes there to learn. You're going to get beat up. And this is something, you know, we've really gotten sensitive to these days. And students are snowflakes, or everyone's afraid to offend anyone. And I think you need to be offended. I think you need to get your butt kicked. I think you need to be betrayed and hurt. And you need to get out through that. Get to the other side of it so that you can handle adversity and you can be composed in the face of it and not reactionary.
All right. Do you think in that perspective, it's kind of like a Joseph Campbell hero's journey kind of perspective?
For sure. I mean, he's, you know, a master. So
yeah, when you come out on the other side kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's. Yeah, you transformed. Yeah. Let's just jump straight into this play here for people running an Alexander the Great inspired podcast. I can't resist any longer. What were your inspirations for jumping in on Aristotle and Alexander?
Yeah, I realized that there was not, for as famous as these two people are, there was really no fully explored stories about their time together.
Yeah.
We don't really know what happened. Aristotle certainly didn't know Alexander was going to be as successful as he was. So he wasn't taking notes. This was a job. He went up to Macedonia to tutor a kid, and the rest is a giant question mark. So it is ripe for theatrical exploration.
It absolutely is. And you know, and you make a good point, because I found myself impressed several times over with a lot of the little details that made it into the play. And because you mentioned how Cassander and Ptolemy, who we're talking about right now, studied with Aristotle. And I remember when I was writing those episodes that I was intrigued by just the amount of digging I would have to do to get a rare throwaway reference to the fact that Cassander and Ptolemy did also study with Alexander, whereas in any secondary source, they talk about it as if it's just, oh, yeah, it's just so well known that he studied with him. But in fact, when I would look at the sources, very often it would just be a passing reference that Alexander would say, Cassander got this from Aristotle, which gives us the ability to say, oh, I guess he studied under him too. So yeah, there is just so much.
Yeah.
Well, that's a perfect segue for me to jump in, and just my first of many points of praise is just to say, you really did deep research for this. I caught on to a lot of things. First of all, you like metaphor, don't you?
Of course.
I get the impression that you like metaphor because I started picking up on just so many themes and so many just metaphors that you seem to be exploring throughout the entire play.
And, oh, there's a lot.
Yeah. So, for instance, I was really impressed that you're starting out with the story of Bucephalus taming a wild horse.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are several stories that are overtold, and they're in every book.
Mm.
And the story about taming the wild horse is in every book,
right?
And it's in Oliver Stone's movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just as a writer, I don't want to tell the same story.
No.
Yeah. And so the joke is that the story is that Alexander sees the horse is going crazy, and he turns the horse from its shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And shadow, the story is that the shadow was scaring the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all of those, no one else could do it. I'm like, all those professional horse trainers.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody could figure out that the horse was seeing his own shadow. So I take that trope,
right,
and I twist it a little. And I say that it is, Alexander says, it wasn't his shadow, mother. This horse is too strong to fear mere shadows.
Right.
And I do this throughout the play, where I take an overused trope and just kind of twist it a little so that it's not the same cliche over and over and over.
Well, what I was also getting at there is that it seems that Aristotle had his own wild horse to tame, and it was,
yes,
Alexander. And
that's,
I was wondering if...
Exactly right.
Okay. That was one of those things that, like, I saw that and I was like, I hope I'm reading that right, because if I am, that was super cool.
Absolutely. The wild child.
Yeah. And I had just never thought about that before, which made me feel kind of silly then, because, like, of course he's in a Macedonian aristocrat. He lives in a world of no limitations.
Correct.
He is a wild animal.
Correct.
Yeah, so, and now I'm building on from that. Let me see here. I had to actually stop myself as I was reading the script, because once what I started doing immediately was noticing that a lot of Aristotle's lines were paraphrases, if not direct quotes, from Aristotle's work. So here, a well-made tragedy can cleanse the soul. And I have my notes where, like, it refers to Aristotle's comments on tragedy and music in his Poetics and in the Politics.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was so cool. I immediately noticed when you said, when here we have, like, all people by nature deserve to know, which was the opening line, I think, from Aristotle's Metaphysics, or the quote from Plutarch's Life of Alexander, where he, understandably, you worked with the time frame here, but you have Alex's comment, as Alexander supposedly said about Diogenes the Cynic, if I were not Alexander, I'd prefer to be Diogenes.
Yeah.
Just so impressed by that. Yeah. And I...
So many quotes. Aristotle is eminently quotable.
Yeah.
And so as much of that as I could put in undiluted,
mm-hmm.
I put in. And Isocrates, if you go on the Perseus website, which is the source, yeah. You can read Isocrates' letters.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, Isocrates is different than Socrates.
Of course.
He's later in the historical record, but he was a contemporary, and he was an opponent of Aristotle's. And his letters are called the Philippa, or the Philippa. And he wrote King Philip, Alexander's father, like 10 letters. And he wrote one or two to Alexander, and we've lost the responses, but that was awesome. He's funny. He's mm-hmm. saying, and I put it right into the play, he's saying, you've probably heard rumors about me that I'm old and I wet myself and I'm senile. But trust me, you know, I need to tell you that you are in danger. So lifting these from the actual source mm-hmm. is the best. And the whole thing has been wonderful, because you don't have to worry about copyright.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, just on that note, then, tell me about your research process.
You know, I'm Greek. I'm a Greek American. My parents were born in the Midwest, but my grandparents were born in Greece and came over. So it's the water you swim in. You hear about Alexander the Great. You hear about Plato. You hear about you know, the Greeks invented everything. And I was proud of my culture and proud of my history, and I knew mm-hmm. about it at a young age. So that's the first thing, is it's not foreign, right?
Right.
And then I went to college, and I studied philosophy, and ancient Greek philosophy was the first class, and my teacher was exceptional, Joe Fell at Bucknell University, and he had a way of contemporizing all these themes, and that's where it all started for me. So you read these books more than once if you enjoy them. And over the last 20 years of visiting Greece and going to the various sites and going to the Theater of Dionysus with a play that was produced there 3,000 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Reading it there and hanging out there and realizing this is not a story. The physical location still exists. Mm-hmm. And that's, you could do that around the world for a lot of things, but this is about as far back as you go. This in Egypt. And, you know, the Greek culture ends up being spread out all over Greece. So there, you can do these sites. I drive down the highway, and there's a sign, archaeological site. And you pull over and you're like, okay, what is this, Bronze Age? Is this 700 BC?
Yeah.
So I begin to collect all this info, and I just spread it all out in front of me, either mentally or literally, with books open and maps and stuff. And then I try to spiral it towards the center and find a theme. But the research is the best part. I mean, this is a lifetime of research. And the best part about this particular story is there's not too many facts that leave room for creativity. So we don't know exactly everything that happened, and that's perfect. But the research never stops. It's just some new play. We're doing the play last night, and someone is telling me new information that, you know, I wasn't aware of. So it keeps going. Yeah, it keeps going.
Well, let's talk about the connections between the ancient world and modernity, or some of the disconnects here that the play highlights. Because one of the purposes of the play here is to highlight some discussions between Aristotle and Alexander about ideal governance. Yes. Which is particularly fascinating to me because, and I try to tell my own students this, as one of my professors told me, education in its inception was to take aristocrats and say, okay, you're going to be, you are a person who is almost godlike, who are going to have no limitations. How do we take this uncontrollable phenom and steer you towards creating a world that is devoted to the betterment of its citizens, you know, ideal. And what does that look like? And these conversations, these musings. So that was particularly striking to me. And I just want to let you speak on your motivations there to bring in conversations of ideal governance here.
Yes, it was so fascinating when philosophy is born and people are trying to argue rationally and logically, you begin to become deliberate about how to govern a society. Everyone's living together, they have competing interests, and how does this work? How does this literally work? So, and you have student and teacher before Aristotle, Alexander, you have Plato and debating Aristotle. And then Plato, I believe, and some of my facts, it's been a while, but Plato goes to Sicily to coach it was either Dionysus or someone, it was a ruler, and says, I'm a philosopher, I'm gonna tell you the right way to rule. It's philosophical. And apparently it went very badly. And Aristotle was either punished or like jailed or even sold into slavery, one story says. A young Plato. And then he had to, one of his friends bought him and brought him back to Athens. So that tyrant did not want to hear any political thought. He just wanted to rule how they ruled back then, which was might makes right. Mm-hmm. And then Aristotle comes along, and this is a wonderful opportunity. He has the chance to engender his philosophy in a real ruler. Let's see how it works. I mean, that experiment is still going on today, because you have people, the people behind the people. You have James Carville, and you have Steve Bannon, and you have these guys. Those guys are political philosophers who are trying to, shape and direct a figurehead. Mm. But the thing that you're talking about, which kind of peaks, I think Marcus Aurelius is the most polished philosopher ruler. And someone who was ethical to as much as he could have been in the Roman times. But you have people who can't stick to the ideals once they have power. So it's just a great moment in history where someone who is idealistic, which is Aristotle, saying here's an opportunity to give a ruler an ethical education, to let him know that it's not just about power.
Right.
And he kind of fails, although the play leaves it open, because Alexander was not a normal conqueror. He was accepting of other cultures. He was tolerant. He was he was okay with intermarriage. He was probably bisexual. So I think he learned cultural tolerance, and that the world is bigger than just slaughtering and conquering, although he did that as well.
A little bit.
He was more thoughtful, and he was sending materials back to Aristotle at the Lyceum in Athens. So their education might have been butting heads when he was the student. Alexander was a student, but he was friends enough to continue his relationship with Aristotle, sending botanical materials and fossils and stuff back to Greece. So they were on good terms for the 13 years that they were apart after the tutoring.
Right. So going back to what you were saying about there's more to being a conqueror, or I'm sorry, more to being a ruler than just wielding power. It immediately brought me back to Aristotle and Alex discussing moderation as a virtue, excess as a vice, when they're talking about, and Aristotle asking, what is the most important virtue for a soldier in Alexander tells him, all the courage he can muster. But is there such a thing as too much courage? And Alexander replies that, yeah, when you fight recklessly, and so it follows, then an excess of courage is not a virtue, but
of ice.
So it is, going back to that, you have Aristotle say, in all things it is prudent to find the middle ground, the virtue between the vices. Do you think Aristotle was successful in conveying that lesson? Did it stick with Alex?
You know, I don't think so. And the play, you know, is a tragedy to a degree. The history is a little better, although the Netflix version that dropped recently did a good job of showing, you know, Alex's brutality. So you can't change a leopard's spots. But, you know, one thing that you were mentioning earlier about political philosophy is Plato, you know, the Republic unpacks so much of that, but Plato and Aristotle both thought that the demos, the common man,
right,
was the worst possible choice
for
a government, right?
Especially for Plato,
Yeah, I mean, Plato wants a timocracy, like the people that have been trained. Timos is like a version of honor.
Mm-hmm.
But those things devolve. There are cycles to governments. They keep repeating. We are in, we are in one now.
Yeah,
you have an aristocracy, and then the aristocracy becomes the
plutocracy. Into the,
I mean, and it goes to Greece, it goes to Rome, and we're in one now, and where the world is like kind of bending to the dictator again. And that's because I think people are so overwhelmed right now that you find one person who's strong and doesn't want to try and please everybody, and that is appealing.
Let me ask you, do you, because when you talk about the cycle of governments, yet again, something I find extremely fascinating. Have you read Polybius's own version of that, the Anacyclosis, his cycle of governments?
I have not.
So that cycle of governments is a little bit different between Plato and Aristotle and then Polybius, and rightly so, because they're different thinkers. And so with Polybius, the cycle is start with the monarch, then go to kingship, to tyranny, aristocracy to oligarchy, democracy to mob rule, and then it starts all over again. Whereas with, you know, Plato and Aristotle, we have more, we have a different kind of path, and one of them is the mixed constitution, or the plutocracy versus the timocracy. So I just didn't know if you in your research and noticing the differences between Plato and Aristotle, and now adding to that Polybius, if you had any thoughts on the differences in how they see that cycle playing out, and how you see that cycle playing out, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I we're in it, so it's real and it's frightening. I think I defer to Plato when he talks about, he's the first one to really break down the cycle. Aristotle gets more molecular by collecting constitutions and reading constitutions and. I haven't gone into Rome yet. It's like a whole other world to unpack. But so, yeah, I think I agree that the masses, the hoi polloi, are easily swayed. They are, you know, we have lost honor in politics. It used to be an honorable thing. And now we are into the plutocratic and the aristocratic phase, where you see people are looking for themselves first. And if you can get into a political position, then you can grant favors and you can take advantage of the perks of being a politician. And that's just become accepted. And that's the danger that Aristotle warns about, you know, that the normalcy almost, the banality of it, to the point where we have a convicted criminal running for president, and it seems okay. It's, for some reason, the normalization of it is really foreign to me.
Yeah, you might. I think if you'll indulge me, then I can't resist. I love to trot out this part. So I'm going to read a passage to you, if you don't mind. Yeah. And this is from Polybius, who is a Greek looking at Rome and trying to explain the Romans to the Greeks.
What
but
year?
This would be in the 150s, roughly. He was after the Greeks tried to step up to the Romans, and they were defeated in the Achaean War. He was one of the hostages that was rounded up. But he became friends with the Scipio family and they were patrons to him. And this is one of the first times we get an actual breakdown of how the Roman government functioned through his perspective. And it's not accurate, you know, necessarily, but it's fascinating in it because it's tying into his Greek thought.
Yes.
Which is and he mentions Aristotle and Socrates and Plato here. Let's see here, because he's talking about at the end of the cycle, and I'm going to read this to you, because from what you just said, I think you may find this to be particularly foreboding and creepy how it looks very similar. So, when a state has weathered many great perils and subsequently attains to supremacy and uncontested sovereignty, it is evident that under the influence of long-established prosperity, life will become more extravagant and the citizens more fierce in their rivalry regarding office and other objects than they ought to be. As these defects go on increasing, the beginning of the change for the worse will be due to love of office and the disgrace entitled by obscurity, as well as to extravagance and avaricious display. And for this change, the populace will be responsible when, on the one hand, they think they have a grievance against certain people who have shown themselves grasping, and when, on the other hand, they are puffed up by the flattery of those who aspire to office. For now, stirred to fury and swayed by passion in all their councils, they no longer consent to obey, or even to be the equals of the ruling caste, but will demand the lion's share for themselves. And when this happens, the state will change its name to the finest sounding of all, freedom and democracy, but will change its nature to the worst thing of all, mob rule.
It's shocking. I mean, that's 150 BC.
Yeah.
And we're in it.
Yeah, and I remember sitting in one of my seminars, and this is book 6 from Polybius, by the way, and that would be chapter 57 if you ever want to go hunting. And my advisor looked at us and he's like, does that sound like anything that you know is going to happen in the late Roman Republic? And, those of us in the class were like, well, yeah, that's Caesar and Pompey. And... Right. And he said, like, now this guy is predicting them 100 years before they popped up.
Right. Amazing. Well, we've been talking about what's happening in our country for about 20 years.
Yeah.
Since the right kind of jumped into bed with the religious, that was very intentional. That was
Yeah.
And now we're seeing it 20, 30 years later. Yep. We're seeing the results of that.
Yeah. That's what I loved. One of the things I loved about this, about your play here, and that you're tackling these issues, because restraint is something you cannot impose on someone who is being told that they are the son of Zeus. So you have to cultivate a world, an environment where they should hopefully choose to restrain themselves. What would you think of the proposal that this is why Aristotle, Plato, Polybius, most Greek thinkers are looking at monarchy as a scary thing.
Yeah.
Dangerous.
Yeah, they were murdering them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the good tyrant.
So fleeting, yeah. Or so, yeah.
You know, I mean, I think about Michael Bloomberg, you know.
Mm. For the most part,
was good for New York. He was a plutocrat, but he had some positives to his reign, plenty to critique. But that would be an example of somebody who had enough money that he wasn't tempted to become a politician for the money and the perks.
Indeed. Yeah, yeah.
But I like also from Polybius the idea of the biggest fear these days is becoming obscure.
Yeah, wasn't that really just frightening, and that really makes us think of someone who's currently a criminal running for office, and it's just the fear of just having to take that L, just to have to. So to bring it back to the play, just building on one more aspect of this, that need for restraint. Later, a couple pages later here, you have Aristotle asking some very leading questions to Alexander. Okay, well, what are you going to do if you conquer all this? And what are you going to do then? And you have Alexander just say, I'm going to keep conquering this. I'm going to keep conquering that. I'm going to become a god. I'm going to conquer everything my father has. That really reminded me of a passage in Plutarch's Life of Pyrrhus of Epirus, who, you know, Alexander's cousin. And it was just this debate he had, and you're nodding, so I think you know the story I'm about to tell, where Pyrrhus is talking to an advisor, and his advisor's asking him questions like this. He's like, what are you going to do when you conquer this place? I'm going to conquer that. Well, I think he says, what are you going to do when you conquer Greece? I'm going to conquer Italy. What are you going to do when you conquer Italy? I'm going to conquer Sicily. And he keeps going and going and going. He says, well, what are you going to do when he's like, I'm going to conquer the entire world? And he said, well, what are you going to do after that? He's like, well, then we drink.
Yeah.
It's this, there is no limit
right
to the minds of someone like Alexander.
Yeah, but we're all there because now it's about more and everything's about more. And, you know, there's a quote in the play from Zeno, which is always filling, seldom full. And that's today. It's, you know, and on every level, you have to keep your appetite going. And we're being sold from the second we wake up to the second we go to bed. So, yeah, Aristotle is telling him to try and control that desire. Otherwise, you will be a slave to that desire.
Uh-huh.
You have to break that cycle and not want.
You think, I've always wondered, when you have these discussions of desire in Greece, Do you find yourself reminded of just, you know, the basic tenets of Buddhism in that?
Yes.
And isn't that it has to be a coincidence because, you know, just the geographic separation, but what do we make of this? It seems to be at least some prevailing theme in philosophical thought that moderation is a key virtue. The notion of desire as something that cannot be sated and therefore the necessity of ruling that always reminded me of some of the basic tenets of Buddhist thought. And I just...
Yeah. So, I mean, I wonder, a lot of that probably migrated east because this is an ancient civilization.
Makes you wonder.
Dionysus was from that side. He was the opposite, right? He was the ultimate glutton. But you get this, and it's a late school of philosophy, you get the Stoics, and that gets taken all the way through Rome. And people misinterpret that, Epicureanism and Stoicism. Yeah,
yes, they do.
It's misinterpreted and
misappropriated even now. I'd go
misappropriated. Especially with the Epicureans. But Stoicism is a moderation thing. Mm. There was some really funny quote in, I think it was Arian or someone, about drinking, that, you know, one glass of wine is fun, two is excellent, you know. Three is the last, you know, the third should be your last. The fourth, you are getting too loud. The fifth, you are breaking furniture. The sixth, you are fucking your best friend. And the seventh, you do not remember what happened.
Yeah. I think there's like an Irish proverb that like a man takes a drink, then the drink takes the man even. Yeah, it's definitely a prevailing, the call for moderation is something that humanity across the board seems to recognize is a wise call to heed. So let's turning to another element of the play is gender that I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
You have pretty soon in the play, you have Aristotle and Alexander talking about theater. And, you know, Aristotle says, you know, yeah, sublime voice. Are you an actor as well? And Alexander says, my father despises the theater. So you have Alexander say to Aristotle, to quote, at my mother's insistence, that is building the theater here in Miesa, not that he's ever here to attend. He thinks it's queer to dress like a queen. So right here, you're talking about the fact that men would be portraying women.
Yes.
But in doing so, they are what we may not use that term as much now, but engaging in what had been referred to as transvesticism, just the idea of cross-dressing. And how that seems to be subversive to Philip. And my instinct there was that you're kind of commenting on the ancient Greek or just the ancient world's imperative for men to always be dominant and always be macho.
Yeah.
No, but then later I see you when Alexander and Aristotle's relationship was at its height in the play, that is, Alexander tries to get a kiss from Aristotle. That passion, that uncontrolled passion comes up and he makes a move on Aristotle, and you have Aristotle demure. And then I'm going to turn to Olympios next, because we have something that I would hesitantly call some proto-feminist themes in the play. So, but just to stay with Aristotle and Alexander, I mean, can you speak on just how you worked in elements of gender and sexuality into your play?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice palette because Alexander plays this. Alexander knows Athenian culture and admires it because it's the height of it. He's being trained to rule, but he grew up with the Iliad and the Odyssey, and all these kids probably play acted that. So he understands a couple essential things. One, you know, having a tutor will make you unique, will make you different, more rounded and more intelligent, better ruler. And then the whole idea of pederasty is that you and your professor have a relationship. And there's a lot of books on this topic, and the best ones say that, you know, we don't know the details of the relationship. But Alex would have wanted to have this relationship with Aristotle. That was the formal relationship.
It seems it was almost like he did it as almost an expected next step.
Correct. Yes. This was that would have validated him in making him more Athenian. You know, once you get outside of Athens, a lot of that theater and philosophy was looked down on. The Spartans were saying, you know, the Athenians are too busy curling their beards and writing poetry, and it's a waste of time. And yet it becomes desirable for those who are able to be open to it. And now we're going to go into Olympias, because I think the reason Alex is sensitive to this stuff is because his mom was the dominant figure and the caring and loving figure. So Olympias is truly such a fascinating historical character.
Yes,
I only found one book on her.
Elizabeth Carney?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. She's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And I think there's more to be researched there. So anyway, she's telling Alex that these characters are mighty, Medea and Electra and Iphigenia. And, you know, it's funny because you have this male-dominated Athenian society where women are not supposed to really be in the marketplace or outside
at all. Yeah, at all.
At all.
People don't take that light. They don't realize the extent of that. Like, women, when they say women were in the household in Athens, they were in the house.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yet the playwrights are all writing about women.
Right.
The gods are women.
Yeah.
Athena is like the goddess of war. I mean, it's a strange contradiction. I don't know if it was some collective like Jungian guilt that you're keeping your women in the house. So, you know, make your women. And Olympias has a different attitude. She is in Macedonia. Macedonian women could have property. They had a lot more rights. They could shop for themselves. They could divorce. So you have this influence on Alex, where Olympias's confrontation with Aristotle hinges on this thing of don't poison my son with your misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's fascinating.
Oh yeah. She, we've talked about her in quite a few episodes, and how she really just comes out of nowhere back onto the political field and unexpectedly just becomes this pivotal force. She's got the, you know, young Alex number four, Alexander's son, you know, by her side, and she retakes Macedon for a little while. And you know, we're also looking at what we've mentioned also when we're reading our sources. They're written by men for men. And so, of course, they're portraying Olympias in this very misogynistic way. And since you've mentioned, you know, reading Elizabeth Carney's work on Olympias, it's, as you said, there's so much work that we can do, because now we can kind of peel back that onion, peel back those layers of who really is this woman, and what was she really doing that she was vilified in such a way that scared the bejesus out of these guys?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about the scene where Olympias catches Alexander dressing in her clothes, and she's talking about bringing in this Kalizina, the Thracian girl, whom when Alexander calls her a whore, she does not disagree.
You know, this is me as an author taking liberties. And we see some scenes of an older Alex with Hephaestion in the movies, right?
Right.
They're in love with each other. So I figure, and I've seen this now as an uncle, boys going through the phase where they're in mom's closet, and I get it, or they're putting on makeup, or they're wearing their mom's shoes, and it may not lead to more, but it is a sensitive side, and this is something that a lot of philosophy discusses in the yin yang. We have a feminine side and women have a masculine side. So Alex is exploring it. He's playing with his mom's makeup. It's like his night out. The music was done by Andreas Fivos, who's a PhD, but also a Greek, and he made all the music with Anatolian instruments. And at that point, it sort of feels like it's like trance hop, but it's with Anatolian instruments. So Alex is like dancing to the music. He's putting his stuff on. He's having a drink, and he's putting on these beautiful clothes. The jewelry is made in Egypt. The cotton is finest, and he's enjoying it. And he's not self-conscious until mom steps in and says, "This is not the behavior of a king." And he has to take that moment of self-consciousness and be like, "I'm still a kid. What I want to tackle on this play." Alex is still a kid. He's 13, 14, and 15 when Aristotle is tutoring him.
Well, here's what I want. Here's what I another thing I noticed about this. So when we started reading this passage, Olympias at first seems that when she first walks in, she's like, "Oh no, what are you doing?" And she looks like she's going to tell him to stop doing this because, as you say, this is not the behavior of a future king. And she starts wiping off the makeup, but he keeps on doing it, and he starts to put on armbands and perfume, and after a while, she starts to help him in the sense of, she doesn't say not to do it. She's like, "You only need a drop or two of this perfume." And so what I'm getting at here is one thing I liked about it is you seem to touch on the fact that our understanding of gender is not necessarily the same as the ancient world. Alexander doing these things and dressing like this, by virtue of him just putting on mom's clothes, that not necessarily made him any less of a man in anyone's eyes. It was the idea of, you're a king. You do kingly things. Don't worry about excessive things. Don't worry about, irrelevant things like your appearance. So and if I'm off base here, you can tell me. But what I was just picking up a very subtle a line that you were trying to walk there of, like, it's not the fact that he's dressing in his mom's clothes that is any concern. It's the excess. He's because you make a point there that in that conversation at one point, I think he does take a giant swig of wine.
Yes. Yeah, we know he and he probably, I mean, my theory is that he got that, from mom. I
Well,
think he got it from his mom, and I think he was, I think she drank, and we know Philip did. But just to address the point, it's a good one. I hadn't thought about it that way. But yeah, it's fun to look at this in that way of, he wasn't self-conscious about it, mom wasn't self-conscious about it. We know that homosexuality in Greece was looked at very differently. And yes, Alexander was a warrior and a sensitive son.
yeah, not or, it was and.
Eddie Murphy had a stand. His first stand-up routine was about, someone making fun of a gay couple, this really buff gay couple. And listen, he put it differently, but he's like, "You forget that these guys are, but they'll kick your ass. They're like going to the gym." So we still absolutely still have it. And this was a moment where I wanted to have that conflicting character trait that makes you talk about it when the play is over. Much different view of male to male love. And Alex mentions the sacred band of thieves. So that's something that a lot of people don't know about. These guys were warriors.
And they were lovers.
It was love. It was about love.
And that was the idea. We talked about that too. Like the sacred band, one of the reasons that they were so renowned is they would not abandon each other because they loved each other. One of the most intriguing things that I ever found was when I began to research it, because ancient sexuality and gender is fascinating to me. When I began to look into it, people speculated they didn't have a notion of sexual orientation the way we do.
Correct.
It was about, passive active dichotomy, that kind of thing.
And it was
Yes.
appreciation of beauty. It's like
Indeed.
Statues.
Exactly. It's this appreciation of beauty. And isn't that something that Socrates and Plato talked about? Ideal form.
Yes.
And just the idea of kalos, just that cultivation of the good and the noble and the appreciation of that.
Yes.
In the physical world as well.
Oh, man, that's where it starts.
Right. And so that's what, and so to finally maybe articulate it the right way, that is what I love about this scene and about how you toyed with that, or rather explored it in the play, because it points out that these are not contradictory notions. The fact that he says Hephaestion has a nice ass does not make him any less of this warrior that the ancient Greek world saw him as.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, actions speak louder than words.
Now, returning to Aristotle and Alexander themselves. In the play, I wonder if this was something I picked up on that was there, if I'm seeing something, or what you think. So in the very first interaction between Alexander and Aristotle, you have them talking about, again, like talking about theater. And he and Aristotle's talking about, I think he calls Sophocles a sick son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's not too much of a stretch for me to imagine he's talking about the incest.
All of it. I mean, he is. And these playwrights are sadists. I mean, you write a play about killing your children for revenge. You're going to write a play about pulling your eyes out. You're going to write. I mean, that's a whole other podcast that we must do, because the playwrights burst onto the scene fully evolved with the most extreme. Like, what was that like to say, hey, we're going to the amphitheater at the base of the Acropolis to see the show. What's it about? I don't know yet. But, you know, it's a theater festival, so let's go. And then that's what they saw.
Yeah.
They saw the crazy plays. So Sophocles is in some of his stuff, he's a sick son of a bitch.
Yeah. And yet when Alexander asks Aristotle, who would you play? And you have him say the most tragic of all, Oedipus. And the reason that I'm really bringing that up is Freud has been, you know, put through the ringer, of course. But that Oedipus complex there, at the heart of it, it's about one of the key aspects of it is about the son, the younger of the two, eventually growing up to supplant the older.
Right.
And then as this play progresses, we have an example where Aristotle whips Alexander into submission.
Yes.
But then in the end of the play, the very opposite happens.
Yeah, this is the kind of the build to tragedy. And it'll be a good point to end or wrap our conversation, because I want to continue. But yes, this is another metaphor of the cycle. So Aristotle says you're a brat in scene. Right. And spanks Alex, and that's the first time that ever had. And then they bond, and he learns a little bit of logic, and he learns to contain his impulses. And then when war is broken out and Alexander realizes he has to go fight, he forgets everything he was taught. He takes revenge on his teacher. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to give away the last moment of the play, but there is a mystery in history as to who killed Philip. And it's a beautiful, beautiful mystery that I leave open. So the play is, it's not a tragedy, but it is tragic because the student didn't learn the lesson.
On that note, then, you've spoken this, like, this is the tragic element of the play. This is a tragedy. I read once that tragedy is defined as right versus right.
Nice.
Would you say that that element is in this play? Is this right versus right?
Yeah, I think that's really, yes. And I think every good scene has that. If you're studying, you know, screenwriting or playwriting, or even as an actor, if you're playing Hitler, you are justified. You must justify that person's behavior. He thinks he's right.
Right. As evil as he may be, he thought he was correct.
He thought he was correct. And you and conflict is, you know, two people going after the same thing, each feeling justified. So I love that definition. I had not heard it before, but it's a really good distillation of why we enjoy and stay engaged. Now, when you're watching like a Netflix show and it's obvious that one character is evil, then you're bored. You're bored by it. This is the problem with the Marvel films. It's like you do essentially have a one-dimensional antagonist, and he's the bad guy, and he's going to twist the mustache, and we kind of know what's going to happen.
Right.
They've gotten better at it, but so yeah, right versus right is a nice way to put it.
All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show. Will, the other question, and the couple of times we've had people on here, that I like to end with is, would you be willing to come on again?
Yes, Dustin, it was a pleasure. I love to get into it with people who have done the work.
Thank you so much for this. It's been a pleasure. And when you do pop back up and for the next LA run and maybe even New York, I definitely want to encourage everyone to go check out this show, because this was a very intriguing play.
Yeah, we had a good this is a good start, and I will let you know when it continues, and we'll do another one.
Can't wait.
Take care, brother.
All right, you too. So that was it, Meredith. It was a good interview, wasn't it?
That was great.
Yeah, Alex was a really cool guy. You know, I really hope to have him on again one day. And maybe we'll go see that play in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next time, we're going to do... Who is it? Man, I can't remember his name.
Ptolemy Part 2.
Part D. Yeah, the end of the season's drawing near. But until that time, this has been...
The Alexander Standard.
Good night, everybody.